Hello and welcome to The Leap of Faith. Well, our guest this evening, known as a broadcaster, as a businesswoman, and indeed as a person who is, well, influencing people to change the way they think. Our guest is Nora Casey. Nora, welcome to The Leap of Faith.
Thank you.
And congratulations, by the way, on your recent award as Irish Philanthropist of the Year.
Thank you very much. It was a wonderful day, actually. As the taxi driver said to me, well, he asked me where I was going, and I said, I'm going to the Philanthropy Awards. And he said, you're not supposed to shut up about those things. And I said, well, you have a point, actually. You are supposed to keep quiet. It's not something you're supposed to, you know, crow about. But I have to say, this year of all years, I was delighted to receive it because it was for something that, well, firstly, was the hardest gift I've ever given in my life. And secondly, it helped to magnify my voice in the domestic violence space. And so of all of the things, I think as you go through life, it's inevitable that your life experiences start to dictate how you give back. So in my early girlhood, as it were, I was a member of the 300 group, which was fighting for 300 people in Parliament in London, and I was a member of the Women in Media, and you would have seen me in that campaign space. And then when I lost part of my right breast to a tumour, I started to get very interested in breast cancer and working with them. My boy, when he was 9, lost his best friend to lymphoma, to a neuroblastoma, and Make-A-Wish did something magical for us. So it was a very hard year, the last year of his life, where myself and his mum knew that he was dying, but Dara, of course, didn't, and neither did Thomas. And then out of the blue, Make-A-Wish said, what would you like, Thomas? And he said, I'd love to go and blow a grand buying toys. So this day, the stretch limousine came and picked up Thomas and Dara, and they went, and they could hardly spend it, because, of course, Smith's Toy Store and all of the others had given so much discount on the day. But instead of afterwards us talking about St. John's Wort in Crumlin, he always remembered that day, that magical day with Thomas. It was like a little gift. So then Make-A-Wish became very important to me. When Richard died, given that I'm a nurse, I used to think that dying with dignity was vastly overrated. You know, that you died, you died. And unfortunately, he went through this roller coaster of a cancer, which was really so fast, neither Dara or I, or even Richard, could catch up with the fact that he was dying. And before we knew it, he was in the hospice on palliative care. I had no idea he was going to die, by the way. And when it came to the final 2 or 3 days, the doctor said, Paul Gregan, an amazing man, he said, I need to take Dara and yourself into a room and ask Dara, does he want to ask any questions? And he said, I've asked Richard, but he doesn't want to be there. And so we went into the room and Paul drew a map of the body and showed where all the cancer was in Richard's body. You'd be hard pressed to find an organ that there wasn't cancer in at that point. And he said, Dara, do you want to ask me a question? And Dara straight out said, is my dad dying? And Paul said, he is. And that's how I found out that Richard was dying. And, you know, it was a very hard question for him to ask. And that, by the way, is how Richard found out he was dying. Because when Paul went to see Richard afterwards, he said, did Dara ask the hard question? He said, he did. And he said, how did you answer? And I said, yes, you were dying. And Richard said, how long have I got? And he said, just a day or two. So it was an unbelievably fast and difficult roller coaster for me and Dara and the rest of my family. But I have to say, the greatest gift of all that the hospice gave us was a very beautiful death. I can't tell you how important that was afterwards, that he was in this beautiful environment where people really cared for him. You know, he'd been in long queues and long hours in hospital and nobody really asked anything about him. They just were taking his bloods or doing tests or giving him bad news. And then suddenly he's in this wonderful place where somebody would sit for an hour discussing what he wanted to eat for his lunch, or, you know, asked him all about his life and all of the things that he wanted to achieve. And the nurse on the ward knew that I was a nurse in my early life, so she came in to sit with me on the final night. And we were laughing. We were both holding his hand, laughing about something. And of course, because I knew he was within hours of passing, I was terrified I would sleep. I can't tell you why. That became this enormous big thing, because we'd had days and days of, you know, being awake all night, and all his friends came and said a last goodbye on his final day. They all brought food, had a last supper, left. I thought, you know what, I'm going to lie down here on the cot bed next to him and I'll fall asleep and miss, you know. So she said, I'll keep company with you, you know. And over the, you know, this small chatter that was going on between the two of us and this laughter, I felt him taking his last breath. And it was so comforting that there was no drama, that it wasn't shouting it from the rafters. Everybody knew he was going to die. And I got time to spend with him. It was really, when I hear afterwards people talking about their loved ones dying with the clatter of cutlery and, you know, dishes and televisions blaring in wards across the country, the hospice just became something really important to me to fundraise for and to spread the word.
The interesting story is that your husband Richard converted as a Roman Catholic.
Yep.
And converts always have a little extra edge on the cradle.
They do.
Because they do the research and they do the study.
Yes,
what was that like for you?
He was a total bore, by the way, at the time. Richard was always, had been brought up Church of England, but really no faith. That's basically it. So he loved the fact that when he came home to Ireland, that we had this beautiful, we'd go to Ockham Street, and we had this beautiful sort of family, sort of community feel. Of course, St. George's Cathedral is my local church in London, and, you know, I virtually lived there, knew all the priests, and was kind of very involved in that element of the community. Now, I would say to you that Irish people who leave Ireland become better Catholics. That's the reality. So church was always somewhere I felt like it was home. When I was nursing in Scotland, first thing I found is, where's my local church? You know, the mere fact that you're going to Mass with other people, it connects you with a community of people. So I think Richard just felt that that was very important to him, that if he was going to get married to me, that he wanted to be Catholic. And it was lovely. Actually, in a way, you know, all my nieces and nephews thought it was hilarious that we went to his first communion and we went to his confirmation, you know, like a month before he had his first confession, a month before we got married. But it was really important to him, and it was really important to me, the church was. And of course, it was important when Dara came along that, you know, we baptized him, and that, you know, we felt that it wasn't a la carte sermons for us. It was very much part of our life and part of the fabric of our life.
And then, thinking in the time after his death, what that did to your faith.
Well, catastrophically, my son is totally agnostic and will remain so, even though I think he's quite knowledgeable and spiritual. Yes, I completely fell away from my faith. You know, when you lose somebody, I'd lost my sister 6 months before Richard got ill. And of course, I'd lost my father. And there's something about collective grief, you know, where you're going through this period of your life where you feel you're in a vortex of this terrible bereavement and loss. And you wonder, what's it all about? And, you know, why did that happen? So I found no solace in the Catholic Church. In a way, when he died in the immediate aftermath, I was hugely consoled by the Catholic Church, and then I fell away completely. And it was around the time of the abuse scandals. Things were beginning to emerge around the Magdalen laundries. And I'd say there was not just a small crack, but a massive rip between me and the established Catholic Church. In London, I was running the Irish Post, and I remember organising the first meeting, asking survivors to come along. And before I knew it, there were hundreds and hundreds in Camden Irish Centre. And to hear their testimony, I mean, there wasn't a dry eye in the house. It was just so emotional. And I got behind that campaign and tried to help those people and tried to find redress. And, you know, I would say, as somebody who's now come back to my faith, that the Catholic Church, you know, didn't do well throughout that whole period and still doesn't on occasion.
Still,
you know,
occasionally, might be said, they put their foot in it. For example, in relation to still their relationship with women.
Absolutely. And, you know, the issue around women, which I think is interesting, is I'm not too sure I know very many women in my life who want to be priests, to be perfectly honest. I do know a lot of priests who'd like to be married, by the way. But I do think that the Catholic Church misses out on having, I do think women are phenomenal leaders. They're amazing. If I go into a business and I say, you've got amazing men there running your business, but why do you want to fly on one wing when you could be flying on two fantastic wings? And they all get it immediately. They'll say, you know, six global companies that show that women being involved in your business means that you outperform your competitors on every single metric. So I don't know why the Catholic Church doesn't wake up to that, that actually having women and men flying at the same speed would be so much better for them than just saying, you know, that they're relegated to the roles in the laity, which they've increasingly been taking up. And the ministry of the future will be different, regardless.
Have you an expertise, and I think you have, that the Catholic Church particularly could learn from?
Absolutely, because, you know, when you see Catholic churches with 20% and less people turning up, in Dublin in particular, much lower, and you see the inevitability of ordinations going down, and you pin your head. I studied strategic management all my life, so that's my way, is, you know, don't talk about today, talk about the future. So we already know that we're in this space where there's an irrelevance and there's an a la carte sacrament creeping into how we behave towards our Catholic Church. And then you say, well, how is that going to be in 30 years' time when they're not involved in schools or hospitals and people aren't turning up to churches on Sunday? And, you know, where is all that going to go? What's going to happen to the Catholic Church? If you look at, sorry to ping your head over to China, but the interesting thing about China is, you know, obviously they've been through a period where they weren't allowed to practice religion. And even during that period, Catholicism was far higher than Protestantism. And now 11 to 1, people are converting to Protestant rather than Catholic in China. And, you know, the Vatican is, they're making various inroads to connect there. And the reason they do is that, somebody said to me recently, is that every liberal Catholic is really a Protestant. Because in China, I think they see, if I'm going to join a religion, I'll join one that has some more liberal beliefs than perhaps I want to have, you know.
And that's been reflected in Ireland as well, in the way people have approached it. The World Meeting of Families is coming to Ireland later in the year. Have you a support role in that, or have you an engagement in it?
Yes, I work in the fundraising committee, and I have been for quite some time. I think, if you accept the fact that, you know, I'm critical of aspects of the church, I also believe that there's a humanity issue there in terms of, you know, shades of the population. And I don't think all people are good. So therefore, I don't necessarily think that all people who work within the Catholic Church are good. But I do think a sizable element are. And I love this Pope. He's a superhero to me. He speaks loudly through his actions rather than his words. He is the first Pope in my lifetime that I've actually admired. And in a world where I feel there's a lot of evil and corrupt people in leadership positions teaching our young children the wrong values, the wrong messages, there's a man who I believe is steering a path towards something which is much more enlightened. I also think he's a reformist. You know, I think that he's somebody, the same as Archbishop Dermot Martin, by the way, who sees the same thing I do. Ping your brain forward to 30 years. Where are we going? What are we doing? Where's the strategy? And as much as they're trying to push towards that reform, there's obviously a very strong conservative right-wing element that doesn't want that reform. And in a way, you know, I almost think sometimes he can't win. You know, some people think he's too liberal, some people think he's not liberal enough. He's charting a course to an institution that's coming out of a particularly dark period and is forging ahead. And he's coming into an Ireland that's quite changed. You know, I grew up in the Phoenix Park, and my dad and my grandfather were Rangers, so we still live in the lodge there at the North Circular Road. So his first visit was obviously a big, big issue for us, partly because all that red carpet had to be reused in everybody's houses after he left. So we were all left with this bright red carpet in all our houses around the Cabra Road and the Navan Road and the various environments of the Phoenix Park. But it was a huge moment for me in my young, you know, teenage life. And then when I was asked, would I get involved in his next visit, which will also involve the Phoenix Park, of course I wanted to help with it. I had to think very long and hard about, you know, that relationship that I have with the establishment and whether that would outweigh my desire to want to help and to be on board with something which will be magical and special. But I'm so glad I did, because through that I have met some amazing people that I sit and work with. You know, it's sometimes in your life when you say yes, and I don't go on anybody's boards, I say no to everything. So I was surprised myself I said yes. But I have never regretted. I'd say it's almost like my other day job.
Is it a daunting task? I mean, we've heard notions that you might have to look for six-figure donations from single individuals in order to get to your target.
So it's not daunting in that there are a lot of people of high net worth who like this Pope. You only have to look at the regular traffic going over to the Vatican to see that, you know, virtually every head of every tech company has been over to see him. He has, sorry for putting it this way, a superstar quality about him, where people, I suppose, in the past wouldn't have supported a visit by the Pope. There's also something iconic about him coming to Ireland. There's a lot of Irish people who don't live in Ireland who see that as something quite special. When he was in Philadelphia, it was special. I think it's far more special that he's coming back to Ireland. The one thing I'd say is that we have two exceptionally good fundraising teams in America, and, you know, obviously, it's a much easier ask if you've got an awful lot more money than you have in Ireland. I personally don't think the fundraising has been difficult. I think what's been difficult is finding the right corporate partners that fulfil the same values that we would want. So we've done an awful lot of work on, you know, corporates that have good workplace practices, that, you know, have good ethical policies, that good shareholding, you know, that you can definitely know that the brand would be right, you know.
And yet, Nora, the phrase is, you know, he who pays the piper calls the tune. Does that mean that, for example, there can be influence that may come from a more conservative element? We had a situation, for example, of photographs of a same-sex couple being taken from a brochure. Was that, you know, is that one of the concerns that you would have?
So I'd say that if you know this Pope, you know that commercial considerations are not on his agenda at all, 100% not on his agenda. He will do what he feels he's going to do when he comes to Ireland, and it may be homelessness, it may be visits to prisons. So it will definitely have nothing to do with whoever's given donations. Many of our donors to date have done them with no request for anything in return, or at that stage in their life where they feel they want to give and have not asked for anything in return, nothing. So I think that it's not the case that in this regard that anybody who gives funds to this particular visit is looking to... First of all, they will have zero influence, and I have zero influence. This is entirely within the domain of the Vatican as to what he does, and the Pope himself having his own strong views on what he'll do. And secondly, we couldn't work with somebody who was dictating what we did and what we didn't do. You know, that's the reality.
Let's take a turn to another topic, and that is the involvement you had recently in the Two Into You campaign, which I thought was very interesting. What was that about?
So when I was talking to you earlier about the journey of my life and how I end up working with various charities, I guess Two Into You came about because I took a difficult decision in the last year to talk about domestic violence in my own life. It was one of the hardest. I've often said to people, you can give time, you can donate money. Sometimes you can use, if you've any influence whatsoever, you can use that to shine a lens on a particular cause. But this was by far the hardest gift I have ever given, because it was so personal to me. I was so ashamed when I left that relationship. I also assumed that people knew me as a dragon and a formidable businesswoman. Very useful, by the way, when you're negotiating. How would they feel if they knew that I'd spent 9 years with somebody who treated me like that? And, you know, what kind of a doormat would do that? And I just, you know, of course, I've had to come to terms with the fact that this is the doormat sitting in front of you. But that's not the reality. But at the time when I wanted to speak about it, I guess if Richard hadn't died, I might have done it sooner, because I'm a big believer in personal testimony. And it was one of the hardest decisions, because firstly, I had to tell my brothers. My mum and my sister knew, but only really in the final week before I left them. Never told my father. This thing about men in your lives who might want to murder people who do that to you. And, you know, I just think for me, protecting my family from some of the bigger aspects of that story was very important. So here I was about to tell the whole country. I have some very good friends, by the way, who didn't know I was married. I had buried it that deep. If anyone asked me about my 20s, I would squirm and wriggle. And of course, my default position is I had 15 jobs, so I could always talk about that and my PhD and my MPhil and what I was studying for. And so it was one of the hardest things in my personal life to do. My son was by far the easiest, because when Richard died, bear in mind, he'd been through the death of his best friend and we'd never discussed that before he died. And he always said to me, I wish you told me the truth. Maybe he's right. When Richard died, of course, it was the same thing, really. I mean, neither of us knew that he was going to die. So he had heard me and Richard talking about my first marriage, and he said, no more lies. Tell me the truth, what happened there. It was within the first few months of Richard dying, and I told him. And he was upset for me for a few weeks. And, you know, gradually he said, you know, I understand, and, you know, let's move on. And when I thought I was going to talk about it, the first person I talked to was Dara. And he said, absolutely, you have to do it, Mum, because you're the best person to do it, and, you know, and people need you to do this. But when I went on the Late Late, and, you know, even the day before they had a stand-in, I was terrified of doing it. And when I did it, I was beyond mortified, because I didn't do it in a good way. I cried, and I had a lump in my throat. And, you know, when you talk about, like, I couldn't sit here and talk about Richard to you in the aftermath, because I would relive it in my mind. So now it's a few years and I can compartmentalise it when I'm talking about it. But because I'd never really talked about what had happened in my first marriage, I relived every blow, every slap, every punch. And it was just the worst for me. I felt the worst experience, because I wanted to be a strong, formidable advocate for women in the same situation. And here I was, you know, getting unduly upset, I guess. And the next morning, I woke up with the biggest fear. You know, when you might wake up and say, did I do that last night in the pub?
The fear.
The fear. And I woke up thinking, did you really do that on national television last night? It was just, I wouldn't even turn my phone on for 2 days. Then when I did start to go out, I was even more uncomfortable because so many people, not like when Richard was, you know, dead and people were giving you a hug, and it was just these terrible stories from them, fathers about their daughters and, you know, mothers talking about their particular lives, children of people who were in families that were abused. I mean, I totally underestimated the extent of it, how far reaching it is. Now I'm a few months down the road and I felt I have to do something positive. It's not good enough just to talk about it. So I went off, met with Frances Fitzgerald, who gave me a huge pile of documents on the domestic violence bill, got myself briefed with Women's Aid, you know, started to read about it, started reading testimonies. Ray Darcy had agreed to do a programme with women who were abused, so we did that, and I fabulously got to meet other women who were survivors and recognised so many traits that we all had in common. And so I fundraised in the last few months. I think, you know, whatever funds we got, over 20,000 went into a campaign then that was targeting young adults and just letting them know this is a toxic relationship. Do a simple quiz. There's a message campaign. Because if you catch young adults early and they don't do what I did, you don't have women fleeing for the lives of their children at the other end where we're trying to find refuges for them.
We have a guest next week on the programme, Father Alan Hilliard. He's the author of a book called Dipping into Lent, and I believe your paths have crossed.
We have. Within hours of Richard dying, the priest who did the, they call it something else, but basically the last prayers that he had before he passed away, couldn't, we knew he couldn't do the funeral, and a mutual friend said, I have the most amazing priest who can do this. So literally within hours, I found Father Alan knocking on my door, sitting at my kitchen table, and you know what? We just connected. If Richard had been alive, he would have loved that man. And he's become, you know, I always say God took Richard and then gave me Alan, because he's become a phenomenal mentor to my son. Even though he's agnostic, he loves Alan, and Alan is an amazing mentor to him. He didn't just do the funeral. We went on to scatter Richard's ashes in a little group of trees in the Phoenix Park where he asked me to marry him. We have an oak tree, which the Phoenix Park let me plant for him with some of his ashes in the basin. We had his month's mind in the visitor centre, and Alan just became this person who, you know, he was within hours of us chatting. He said, and I'm not around tomorrow. I have to do a wedding. And I thought, oh, he's marrying the couple. And no, he's doing step dancing at the wedding. He's just the most extraordinary man. And he keeps us laughing. And when he said, I'm launching this book, which is typical Alan, by the way. And you can see his, like, I can nearly hear Alan talking in the words in the book because he wrote it, which is magical. Exactly how he speaks. He's like a little, I don't know, spiritual mentor, you know. I chose a reflection which meant a lot to me. And I'll tell you just for why, because the story, when you hear it, is just exactly how you would expect it to be. Because I was sitting, like, you're going to think I'm name dropping, and I'm not. But when I came back from London first, I'd interviewed Mary McAleese quite a few times, and Richard in his BBC capacity had interviewed her husband. And so they invited us to a dinner and we were chatting, and she said, in all honesty, when the twins were about to be born, she said, I thought there wouldn't be enough love to go around. And she's spoken about this publicly, so I'm not preaching any secrets. But it was just this extraordinary idea. She had one child and she said, we are a family of three and then two more were arriving. Would we have the ability to love all of our children? And in a way, when Richard died, I worried if the love would be diminished. You know, if by taking away a parent that somehow there wouldn't be enough love. But of course, who fills the gap? I mean, your mom, your sisters, your brothers, your friends, people like Father Alan, who was such a great man to Dara. And when I read this story, even though it comes from the Bible, I also know a little bit behind the story and I love the idea behind it. So will I read it to you?
Please do.
Okay. It's called The Prodigal and the Mother. He was dead for quite a while and she spoke about him a lot. Every conversation about him seemed unfinished. Something ran deep that was unsaid. Eventually it came out. Her son had lived a colourful life. He'd travelled the world before a strange hereditary disease took him from her. She missed him. But more than missing him, she wondered where he was, more in a deeply metaphysical sense. Now, I'd spoken to her a few times, but on this occasion, I felt compelled to push things a bit. Are you worried about him? In true Irish style, she didn't answer the question directly. I'd say he lived life to the full when he was alive, she said. Tell me, I asked, when did the father forgive the prodigal son? She looked at me and rebuked me a bit. I'm no theologian, she said. I don't know about that. I replied, but you're a mother, and that certainly helps. I continued, go on then. When did he forgive him? When he saw him coming towards the house. Try again, I said. When he said sorry. Maybe. Try again. When he hugged him. And then she said sternly, and that's my final answer. She looked at me, and what's your answer, smarty pants? I don't think he ever forgave him. Well, talk about a livid look. What do you mean, she asked. She stuttered and stammered, protesting and pontificating like mad. She couldn't get her head round what I was saying. Eventually, she fell silent through sheer frustration, even anger. I don't think he ever forgave him, because, well, he never needed to. I added, I don't think he ever condemned him in the first place. Her silence went deeper, and she sat up, carrying a piece that seemed to catch her unexpectedly. She knew immediately what I meant. In truth, I don't know if I'm right or wrong on this one. I only know that when you peel back the idea of God's mercy in the stones and actions of Jesus, we are told that his mercy is richer and deeper than any human concept of mercy and forgiveness.
Why does that work for you?
On two levels, you know, firstly, of course, I'm a mother who has a son, and I always like to think that I will forgive him for anything that he ever does. It's one of the loves that run deep. But secondly, it's the idea of not needing to forgive if you haven't condemned, which is unique in modern society, where sorry seems to be the hardest word and forgiveness seems to be even harder. And in, you know what I always find tragic in Irish life in particular, you see families and they're torn apart in the courts. Family businesses where, because of the succession planning or a will or somebody favouring one over the other. This is just this wonderful little parable about something that is connected to modern life, that her son had obviously died and she had issues around somehow how he'd lived his life. And because of that, she was worried about him in the afterlife. She worried about where he might be. And then Alan is coming along saying, but he never needed to forgive. It was just nice little revelation, you know.
From Alan Hilliard's book, Dipping into Lent, and Alan is our guest on the programme next week. Nora Casey, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.